This is the Mindvox podcast, hosted by Claire Jacobs. Mindvox is a space to talk about our minds and mental health, so we cover topics that can be of a triggering or sensitive nature. We will always highlight the topics we cover in the show notes of each episode's description, so please read these before listening. Please note, we're not medical experts, we're only experts of our own mental health experiences. To find out more about the pod or contact us, find us on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter using the name Mindvox Pod. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Mindvox. I have with me today Susie Glasky, and she is a functional medicine health coach and founder of Peppermint Wellness. During her career as a PR boss, Susie became underweight, exhausted, and constantly burnt out. She believes her previous career created toxic stress hormones that led to a constant flood of inflammation in her body. These health conditions and the death of her father led Susie to retrain as a health coach, where she learned various ways to reduce burnouts and improve well-being. So clearly, I really obviously wanted her to come on to talk about her journey. And she wants to share her ideas about the way the body can heal itself and prevent future burnouts. How are you, Susie? All right?
Do you know, I'm great. Thank you. I really am. I'm looking forward to chatting about this because it's such a huge subject. And I feel like having come through, I really want to kind of share this message with as many people as possible.
Brilliant. I mean, I'm really looking forward to hearing your tips about burnout in particular, because I think actually I am going through it at the moment in quite a bad way. So if I can get some ideas on it, that'd be brilliant. And I think this isn't just for people with neurodivergence. Neurotypical people go through burnout, breakdowns. You know, everyone at some point in their life can really get to a point of exhaustion. But I think with neurodivergent people in particular, those that are autistic, those with ADHD, like myself, we have a tendency to go through burnout a lot more often. And I think that's to do with masking and having to live in a society that's not really built for the way our brains are. So it's exhausting. And I think, yeah, like I said, right now, I think I'm going through that. So I'm eager to find out if there's natural ways to help myself. I think my first question is, what is burnout? Because there will be some listeners who aren't familiar with the term, or maybe using the term, and actually that's not what it is that they're describing. So from your point of view, what is burnout?
Yeah, it's a real buzzword that's being bandied about more and more. And I think particularly, I mean, even before lockdown, there was the incidence of burnout was just going through the roof, and then lockdown happened and things were even worse. But it shows up in kind of different ways in different people. So it could be, you know, the inability to fall asleep, inability to switch off, feeling generally low, feeling that you can never get on top of things. Like however hard you try, however early you get up or late you work, you just can never feel that you are on top of things. And it's when you kind of start to not enjoy things. Like even when you are, say, supposedly doing fun things like with your family, there's just kind of no joy there. Everything's very, very flat. People can get kind of physical symptoms sometimes. So it may be like sort of heart palpitations, breathlessness. You know, there's all sorts of different ways that it can show up. But yeah, it's unfortunately something that many women are more and more familiar with. And certainly when I was feeling like that, I didn't really understand that I was not dealing well with the stress. I had lots of physical symptoms, but I never joined the dots and realized that there was one core underlying, you know, cause of all of that. And that was stress.
Yeah, because I had a little nosy, as I always do on your website. And you did talk about how you had quite a successful PR career. Now, PR is a very stressful type of job to go into, but you went quite high up into it. So I can imagine the levels of stress that you were receiving each day. I mean, what was your burnout like? Like, how did that begin? Do you remember very much about what started to happen for you, that you could sort of give a bit of information about your journey?
Sure. So, I mean, the first thing to say is I always feel really embarrassed when people say that PR is a stressful job. Because you think, well, how stressful can it be compared to like a firefighter or, you know, somebody who's working shifts, you know, at night in a hospital? Like, how seriously, it's an office job. Like, how bad can it be? But Funnily enough, it does show up consistently as one of the most stressful jobs.
Yeah, it might not be the physical stuff, but you've got that daily stress of having to meet certain criteria and that pressure. Yeah. I think for that, it's a very pressured job. Obviously, you're not saving lives, which is a different pressure, but
it's
the daily admin pressure of, can I meet these targets? Can I market this correctly? Can I please these clients?
And that's it.
It's a very high pressured job in a different way, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think anything in it, when you're in a service industry, when you're having to please clients on a daily basis, and you get one thing, you get one great piece of coverage, but then the next day it's like, well, what have you got today? And it never kind of ends. You're like, because you know, the media, it never ends, does it? You know, it's like the next day you got to do it all again. So I actually really enjoyed working in PR up until the point about 21 years ago where I moved to a new job. I had two very young children. One was my youngest son, Louis, was only a few months old when I started in this job. And it was a commute away. So I had been working in a job that actually was walking distance. And I moved to a job that was a commute. And it was a busy commute. I'd be stuck in traffic every day. So the commute itself was extremely stressful. And I was the sort of person who would leave my office until the last possible moment, because I always wanted to get one more thing done, you know, send one last email. When I should have been on the road, I was kind of like this with my bum in the air, just like pretending to myself that I was already on the way to my car, but I wasn't. I was still sending an email. So I was always late to pick up from nursery, and I was always getting, you know, I'd get fined, and, you know, I'd find my kids waiting outside in their coats on a freezing day, and I'd feel very guilty, like constantly guilty, constantly sick at myself. But on the other side of the equation, I had a very demanding boss. I had very demanding clients. I had clients who, the sectors they worked in, you could just tell they didn't really want to have a mum on their accounts. So I would almost pretend that I didn't have children. And I know that sounds a ridiculous thing to say, but it just wasn't a welcome thing. So I was trying to pretend that I was not a mother and that I had all the time in the world for my clients. And the reality was that I had two tiny children who took it in turns to be ill, and one of whom was up every hour of the night. So I was exhausted. I mean, absolutely exhausted. I remember I would have this commute to work. And I remember one day I could feel my eyes just closing, and I wound down the windows. I put the radio on loud, but I shouldn't have been behind the wheel of a car. I mean, there was no question. I should not have been driving a car. So these were the sorts of things. I would wake up in the morning and you would just pray that they'd be well enough to go to nursery, you know, because I had to get to put them somewhere so I could get to work. Otherwise, I would get into trouble. And sometimes nursery wouldn't take them because they had like conjunctivitis or whatever. And I'd literally just chuck them at my mum. My mum lived about 20 minutes from my house. And I remember one time she was not well. She just had an operation. My dad was elderly. But I just literally chucked these children at them because I had to get to work, you know. And so it was this constant anxiety and stress, like a kind of knot in my stomach. Would I be able to get to work, you know, dreading the call from nursery that I had to go and pick them up because one of them was ill. So yeah, it was that sort of thing. And then what started to happen is I was getting odd physical symptoms. So it started with a really, this red eye. I actually got it after I resigned and my boss persuaded me to stay. And the next day I had this horrendous red eye, like bright red. I look horrendous. And you know, in PR, you're supposed to look well turned out, you know, you're supposed to like dress nicely and be properly made up. And I looked absolutely horrific. I was really embarrassed to see clients, which I had to. And I kind of look back now and it was like a red alert. I understand now what my body did. It threw out a red alert, like, you idiot. Why can't you see this? You need to leave this job now. And I tried eye drops and I tried all different medication. I couldn't get rid of it. And it stayed for 3 months until I resigned for the second time properly, and it cleared up the next day. That's how clever the body is.
That's crazy, isn't it? I've had some red eyes recently, but they're both of them. It sounds like you had one.
I just had one. But
I take it down to like really tired, and the eyes are just like, I can't cope much longer. But what do you think that actually was then, now that you've trained in that? What caused the eye to do that?
Well, the thing is, you know, our body's always fixing itself, right? You know, the body is an incredible, miraculous piece of engineering, and is constantly fixing itself. So, you know, a red eye for a healthy body really shouldn't be much of an issue. You know, you get things in your eye and then, you know, your eye is self-cleaning. But my eye would not fix itself because I was so full of stress hormones, which cause inflammation in the body. So we know that stress is a toxin, it causes inflammation in the body. And I was inflamed and it was showing up in different ways, one of which was this red eye, which I do see as a red alert. It was kind of like, yeah, yeah. But I was ignoring it. I was just like, oh, let me put more makeup on, you know, but obviously you can't put makeup on your eyeball. So that was a problem. But for everything else, you know, when I would find myself looking in the mirror in the toilets at work and I would look gray, one day my legs just gave way in the toilet, but I still insist on driving to a meeting. And I would just be putting more blusher on to try and look normal. So I would just be piling on this under eye concealer. But it was all a sticking plaster because I was just crumbling. I was just falling apart and coming undone at the seams from the stress. And no amount of makeup or power suit could make up for that. And I started losing a lot of weight, even though I was eating a lot of crap. You know, I wasn't eating. Now I look back and I think, actually, I wasn't really eating that well at all. But I was thinking, oh, right, I'm losing weight. I better have some more calories because I understood nothing about nutrition at the time. So on top of my brie baguette for lunch, I'd get like a chocolate brownie. I thought that will work. But of course, that wouldn't work because I was just pouring more fuel on the fire by having more and more sugar, which causes more inflammation. And I remember losing this weight and people commenting, you look very thin. And one of my colleagues who was an older woman, and she came up to me one day and she said, what's your secret? And I said, what do you mean? What's my secret? She said, how are you managing it to lose weight? And I was like, are you joking? Do you actually think I want to lose weight? You know, I was like a size 10. Why on earth would I want to make myself thinner? But, you know, in that world of PR, that was seen as something desirable, even though it was from a state of a sickness.
That is, yeah, no, that's awful. So work really got difficult, having to juggle the kids as well. I mean, yeah. Did it start to affect relationships from friendships and family when you got worse, or was it mainly work and kids that were the main problems?
I think that affects everything. It leeches out into every aspect of your life. You know, if you come home and, you know, like Sunday evenings, I would just cry at the thought of going back. I mean, I would cry a lot on my days off. That's the thing. So it certainly affected my kids because it wasn't just while I was physically in the office. It's every minute of the day. So when I would go on holiday, I remember having this beautiful holiday and being on a beautiful beach, but I might as well have been in Manchester because I was in body, I was on that beach, but I was just consumed with anxiety about what would happen when I went back to work and was my account exec, because I was an account director, was my account exec doing what I'd asked her to do? And as it happened, when I got back to work, she hadn't done a thing. And so it was like, I was immediately plunged into absolute, you know, horror and stress. And so it didn't really matter where I was constantly thinking about work. So even when I was at Mummy and Me with my little boy, who was 9 months old, I remember thinking, I made it to Mummy and Me. This is great. And a girl I know, she's not a close friend, but she came up to me, she said, Susie, I've never seen you looking so unhappy. And it really gave me a jolt because I was at Mummy and Me with my gorgeous little boy. Like, you know, this was the good time of the week. But the strain was obviously etched on my face, even though I wasn't at work, because I knew that at any moment, my phone could ring and a client would be put through to me, because that's the way it worked. I was in the office 3 days, but the rest of the time, they would just put a client through to me just so I could get a call at any point. And so you constantly had your heart in your mouth because you didn't know what would happen, like from 1 minute to the next. I remember getting one call when I was actually with my older son, who was about 2.5 at the time, and I had to speak to this client. It was a lawyer. And my little boy wanted to show me a picture and I didn't know what to do with him. And I closed the door and I locked it so I'd be able to have this call. I look back now and I feel sick. Like, what kind of mother locks a 2-year-old in a room? You know, it's like child cruelty. And he was screaming. He was screaming and I could hear him screaming. And I thought, what are you doing? What are you doing? Just open the door, give him a hug. But I couldn't, because I couldn't bring myself to say to this client, you know what? I'm so sorry. I just can't speak to you right now. Can I call you back in half an hour? But I didn't feel I could do that. And now I feel sick with, the things I had to do to look professional.
Well, that also reflects on the place you got to mentally, doesn't it? Of how burnt out you were, that even making decisions like that was probably quite difficult because your head really wasn't where it usually would be. I think a well you would have prioritized your child and said, look, I need to phone you back. Give me 5 minutes. This thing, I have a feeling from what you're saying that that isn't the usual you. That's a burnt out you. I mean, where did it get to? How far did it get? What took it to a point where you were like, right, something's got to change now?
Well, it was actually my GP, bless him, because I went along because I dropped to under 8 stone, which for my height is very, very light. And he sort of weighed me, and he was very firm. And he said, "Look, if you carry on losing weight, your periods are going to stop." And that really gave me a jolt, and I didn't want that to happen. And I realized that I actually had to do something, and so I resigned properly the next day. And from that moment, there was kind of like an exhalation because I knew that although I still had a few weeks to work my leave, I knew that the end was in sight. And that's why my eye was able to heal and I was able to start breathing a little easier, knowing that it was going to end within a few weeks. And it took me a while to put the weight back on, actually. I remember leaving on the final day and it felt like I was walking out of prison. It was that sort of feeling of total relief. Total relief. But I was very, I wouldn't use the word damaged, but I was like a wrung out dishcloth, and it took me a while to get back to being my full self. I remember one day, must have been about a couple of months later, I tried to put on my jeans, which were a ridiculous size. They were so tiny, and I couldn't get them over my leg. No, I'm not, it wasn't that I couldn't do it around my tummy. I couldn't get them over much past, mid-thigh. And I remember being so happy. Because I thought, you know what, that means I'm coming back to me if I can't get these ridiculous like doll sized jeans on. And I remember a few days after I had that last day at work, I would be at my sink washing up or washing veg, and I would suddenly go like a huge inhalation of breath as if I'd been underwater, and it would happen quite involuntary, and I realized it was like me finally breathing because I hadn't been breathing properly for that full year. I'd been kind of holding my breath. So it was really interesting. I look back now, I find it very interesting to see how my body reacted. Yeah, as a health coach, I find it fascinating. It wasn't interesting at the time, it was horrendous. But yeah, I do find it really awesome how what the body does, how intelligent it is, how it's talking to us all the time. It's just that we don't understand what it's saying. I totally ignored, misunderstood, misread all of the signals it was giving me. And it was screaming at me, but I just didn't understand it. I wasn't prepared to listen. That's the truth.
It's hard, especially if we don't have the knowledge of what to look out for, I think. But now you have that with the work you do now. In hindsight, you can see that was happening. This is the physical things that were happening, which clearly meant I should have got out earlier or whatever. But I mean, so you left your job and that helped. But like you said, it was quite a process still. So that was one thing that did give a bit of an immediate relief. But like you said, you were still unwell and had to repair and heal. What other things helped you at that time once you'd left work to get back to being you? What did you have to start doing?
Well, I didn't at that time have any knowledge that, the knowledge that I have now. So I wish I could go back to that 21 years, and I would give myself a whole load of advice of things that I do now, that I do now daily, that would have been hugely helpful. But I think the main thing was that I recognized that even though I didn't have another job to go to, and obviously that was scary financially, that for my I realized I was going to end up in a very bad place mentally, unless I actually just walked away. And then I think I had the faith that something would turn up, but I didn't have the headspace in the job to even think about what I would do afterwards. So I had to actually walk away, have the space. And then I actually started freelancing. So I don't actually remember at that time what I was doing for my self-care. I don't think I was doing an awful lot, to be honest, but having your own autonomy, knowing that no one could ever tell me again not to pick up my sick child, because that's what had been happening, as I was told that I couldn't pick up my child when nursery called saying he's being sick, you need to pick him up. So just the knowledge that that would never happen to me again was huge in helping me to kind of look forwards. And I resolved that that would never happen again. And so I did start freelancing, and then actually it turned into a very big agency, which then was very stressful. So then I got a whole load of other stress of being a boss of a very big agency.
Oh, you went almost back into it then. So did you end up getting burnout again because you were back into a pressure job?
Yeah. So what happened then? I had another child. So then I had three children. But it was actually grief that forced me out this time, because my dad passed away. And I actually left the whole thing. I literally walked away from the agency that I'd founded. Very suddenly, I walked away a few weeks before he passed away, actually. And then when he did pass away, I didn't cope with it well. I got very stuck in grief. And grief is, is something that is not predictable. It's different for every person. For me, it got progressively worse as the months went on. So as the months went on and people expected me to kind of be back to myself, I was getting worse. So at 5 months, I was worse than at 1 month. And what I eventually did was I got help from a friend of mine who'd recently trained up in something called EFT, Emotional Freedom Technique, which is also known as tapping. And I had two sessions with her and I couldn't believe it. It was like night and day. I got my smile back. I was able to be around people again, which I hadn't been able to be around people because I would just cry when I was around. You know, I really wasn't coping well. And then that was the catalyst. So it was my dad's passing that was the catalyst for me starting a new career.
Gosh, that sounds a lot, isn't it? Because like you said, being stuck in grief, I mean, I don't know if he passed with you knowing that was going to happen or whether it was
We did know. He was very elderly and it was it was totally on the cards, but still I was surprised how I was affected in the way, but I was and you know, once you get stuck in that, it's very difficult to get yourself out of it.
Mm.
It just was totally lodged, you know. It wasn't moving at all. It wasn't progressing.
So how did you manage to get that while you're stuck in the grief? How did you manage to get the motivation to change career within that? I mean, is that
kind of,
because obviously when you're stuck, motivation to do anything, I imagine, is probably
I did nothing during those 5 months. I remember I went to my allotment a lot. I had an allotment. And it was really nice to go there by myself and just be out gardening. I remember doing that, but I wasn't working at all. I'd left my agency. I didn't want anything to do with it. And I certainly couldn't think about doing anything else. So it was only after I'd had the EFT that suddenly it was like a light switched on. And I thought, my goodness, I want to train up in this, which I did. And then from there, I came across health coaching. And I immediately fell in love with it because I loved that it looked to the whole person. So it wasn't just looking at the food, you know, sleep, movement. It was looking at the emotional side, the spiritual side, the mental side of a person. And so I trained up in that and I never looked back.
That sounds great. I mean, I have interviewed someone about EFT before on the pod. I think I did two sessions with her and she did a little bit of tapping on the second episode so I could try it. And it was a really interesting way of doing it. And I've heard recently it's getting very popular now in helping things like ADHD, but also anxiety, stress. It's ways of sort of coming out and grounding yourself in that moment. But people also say there's science behind it in terms of not just helping you in that second to ground, but actually it can release things from a long time ago. It can release long-term stresses so that you can sort of move on. And it sounds like it did that really well for you to the point that you actually trained in it and then went forward and trained in another career.
Which is
brilliant. But in terms of your current career then, a functional medicine coach, if I can say that properly, what is that? And why did you choose that?
So yes, I am a functional medicine health coach. Functional medicine is a model of medicine where they look at the whole person rather than here's your head, go and see a psychiatrist for your head, or here's your digestive system, you go and look at a specialist for that. They look at the body and the mind as an integrated system with everything being related to everything else. And it's a system which looks very much at prevention. So rather than kind of looking at treating symptoms, it's always looking at the underlying cause. So as a health coach, I help people to adopt the little lifestyle habits which help them to thrive, not just physically, but you know, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually as well. So everyone knows that we need to eat healthily, right? You know, no one, that's not news to anybody. Everyone knows, yeah, we don't, we're not supposed to eat too much sugar. You know, we're supposed to eat lots of vegetables and drink water. But having that knowledge is simply not enough. Like I will constantly come across people who know, of course, they should be drinking a glasses of water a day, but who are drinking no water at all. And it's not that they don't know it. It's just that they can't, it's not their habit. They can't get into the habit. And equally, people who know we're supposed to be getting 8 hours sleep. Yes, we've been told a million times, but their habit is to be on Instagram at 1 o'clock in the morning. So having the knowledge is frankly very ineffective at actually adopting these things as a practice and baking them into your daily life. And that's where a health coach comes in. So I hold people's hand through the process of adopting the habits that they would like to adopt, but haven't been able to do on their own.
That sounds interesting. You described my life there, and it was very uncomfortable.
Oh, I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable.
I'm just not a fan of water on its own, to be fair. It's just not, doesn't do it.
It's very bland. Yeah. So
and even some... ice cold is okay. I put cucumber in it sometimes.
But yeah,
it's
perfect.
It's that remembering to do it. So it is kind of, we go back to the ADHD, the topic I always talk about. I do forget.
And totally. Totally.
And in front of me, I'll be looking at it going, I'm thirsty, I need to drink. And it's sitting there right next to me, but I won't remember to then pick it up. So I don't know how a coach would help that situation.
Do you know what? It's about finding a strategy that works for you. And what might work for your next door neighbor will be totally different for you. And that's it's like a dance with a client, because you know, one person, it might help to walk around with a water bottle that has a measure and shows how much. And for another person, that might not work at all. So, for example, I just coached recently the editor of Tops on Tay, who's a fantastic lady called Katie. And if you can imagine, you're the editor of the top-selling health magazine, how much knowledge you must have about, because that's what you're doing every day, is reading information about health and editing it. So she knows everything about health and well-being. But that doesn't help her actually put these things into practice. And the way her mind worked, she really struggled with things like remembering to drink water, you know, remembering to have lunch, you know, remembering to switch her phone off, very busy mind. And she came up with her amazing own strategies. So for example, for switching her phone off, she wanted to detach from her phone, but she couldn't because we're all addicted to the phone, right? She came up with a song that she wrote herself. It was a little ditty because she's very creative, extremely creative, very into like music and dance. And there was a program from the, I think it was the 1990s, called Fraggle Rock, a kids program. And she used the theme tune and she made up her own lyrics. And she left me a message on WhatsApp with this little thing she sang. I loved it. I said, Katie, that's it. That's what. So she would sing herself this little ditty to music to remind herself to put her phone away and now it's time to switch off. But if I would have come to my next client who was struggling with phone addiction and said, here's what I want you to do, I want you to sing a song with a Fraggle Rock tune, they would have looked at me like I was insane, like, what the hell are you talking about? So that's the thing, it's finding the thing that works for you.
I kind of like the sound of that, but again, it'd be me remembering to actually sing that song. I love Fraggle Rock.
Exactly. So probably, you know,
yeah, and then there's probably are ways of doing it, isn't there? It's just trying to find that thing that works for you. And like you said, I know what would be good, but it's putting it in practice that I struggle with. I know I shouldn't eat the things I eat.
Yeah.
But when the time comes, I'm rushing and I really don't have
exactly.
It's just what I grab. I have my little list of this is exactly what I'll just have for lunch. I can't be bothered to try and think of anything different, even if
exactly.
Yeah. So I get what you mean, why you need to do that. And I guess now you've learned all the things you've learned within this role, looking back at the burnt out version of yourself, what small changes in your lifestyle would you have made using what you've learned to try and help get through the burnout or even prevent it happening again?
Yeah. Certainly I would have been a lot better with boundaries. I would have, I think I had such low self-esteem, although I was at a very high level in my job. I was insecure because I was a working mum in a field where that was, you know, it wasn't great. And I knew I was part-time. So I always felt that I was on the back foot and that I had to work extra hard to prove myself. And I'm really hoping that that things have moved on in the past 20 years. So I guess I would first thing have had better boundaries. I would have, and this is really hard with young children, but I would have tried to have time in the day just for me, because I never had a minute. And you know, I used to read, okay, when I went to the dentist, I'd read the magazines, the health magazines, like, yeah, do an hour's meditation, do an hour's yoga. And I think, like, what the hell? Like, I can't even go to the toilet, you know. And actually, there was a day where I remember going to the toilet at work. I hadn't been the whole morning. I suddenly thought, gosh, I haven't done a wee. And I went to walk to the toilet, but I didn't want to waste a moment. So I was talking to myself, I need to answer this email, I need to call this client. Duh, 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 duh. And I remember getting on the toilet, starting doing a wee. And after a few seconds, I thought, this is just taking too long. I haven't got time for this. It's taking too long. And I just cut it short. Mid-flow, cut the wee short, zipped up, washed my hands, rushed back to my desk. So that was where my mind was, that my body deserved nothing. You know, I had so little respect for my body that I wouldn't let it even empty its bladder. So I certainly would have been far more aware of what my body was telling me. When I needed a drink of water, I say, go and get a drink of water. You know, if you need a wee, go and do the wee. And I guess I felt so guilty about working that I wanted to spend every minute that I wasn't doing nice things with the kids. But the truth was, I was very short tempered. I was very impatient because I was exhausted. You know, I wasn't sleeping. So I would have gone, if I would have gone back, I would have understood you need to prioritize your sleep. You know, and if that means that you can't go to this play group, whatever, or do this, that, the other. And I would have asked more of my husband, frankly. I would have said, I'm sorry, I need you to get up at this time or do this or collect from nursery. I would have been much more vocal about that.
I think those bits sound like trying to put in little bits of self-care, isn't it? Because self-care isn't just bubble baths and chocolate.
No, it's not.
Like, take a bit of time each day for yourself. And I think even an hour is quite a lot, you know, for like you said, a working parent.
Oh, yeah, I didn't have an hour.
10 minutes just having a cup of tea mindfully, really noticing that you're sitting there having that tea that's not going to go cold because you're busy, and just having that 10 minutes of even putting, you know, if it's a young kid, I do remember I used to try and put my son, he said, Paw Patrol back in the day, sit him with a 20 minute episode or 15 minutes, and that would be my time to sit on the sofa, have a cup of tea, and just try to just zone out for a little bit, because there was no other time. And I know people sometimes say TV's bad, but actually, no, not for little bits of time. If he's absorbed in that, and I, as a single parent, I had no one else. There was no one I could give him to for half an hour so I could go for a walk.
Absolutely.
I was on my own. So I had to still be in the building making sure he was safe.
Yeah. But
having that bit of downtime mentally is the only way you're going to get through, isn't it? And I think when you're in burnout, it's really hard. Like, I feel like I am in it now, and I know I'm supposed to rest. Like you said, I know I'm supposed to take self-care, but I feel like there's not enough time. I've got too much to do. I have to keep getting it done, and then I can finally rest if I get it all done. But those things never all get done. So
that's it.
If you had a client coming in with that particular issue, what strategies would you start trying to get them to explore?
Yeah. So the first thing is to help them with self-compassion, because I think it can be like, I haven't got a minute, but I know I'm supposed to be like eating well. And then it's another stick to beat ourselves up with. Like, here's another thing that I'm failing at. You know, I'm also failing at self-care. I always start with self-compassion, because I think women have just had enough of beating themselves up. Like, I bought all these health eating books and I listened to this podcast on, you know, on self-care and health, and I'm doing none of it, you know, and it can just make us feel so frustrated with ourselves. And then it's starting with the tiniest thing. It could be going to bed 10 minutes earlier with a book, an actual book, which feels like such a treat. It could be, you know, just the simple fundamentals of having a glass of water before your morning coffee. And then you do that and you think, oh, okay, right, I'm doing that. And then it's kind of, and I will say, like, that's amazing. You know, that's so great. You've managed to have a glass of water, because we need praise. You know, we need someone to actually pat us on the back. We don't get praise. You know, we just don't. It's never me prescribing. It's always me asking them what they feel ready to do. So one woman might say, do you know what? I feel like I could go for a 10-minute walk before I have my lunch. Amazing. Okay, great. Where will you walk to? You know, what do you need to do? And then when they've done that, it's kind of Again, that's fantastic. Like, what do you feel ready to do now? But the problem is when we go into this and we think, right, I need to start overhauling my sleep. I need to overhaul my diet. I need to cut out sugar and alcohol. And I need to start exercising. I need to start meditating. I need to start doing yoga. And it just freaks us out because it's too much. It's too much. And we end up abandoning the whole thing and then going, sitting down with a packet of biscuits because we're totally overwhelmed. So we need to start with the tiniest thing. That's the thing to do. And you'll know, Claire, what that thing is for you. If I were to ask you, you'd say, do you know what? This is the thing I can start to do in the next couple of weeks to feel better. There'll be one tiny thing that you know, because you've got all of the answers. You've got all of the resources that you need. You've got all of the creativity. You've got it already. All a health coach does is help you to bring these out, help you to actually find your own solutions that you already have. I mean, that Fraggle Rock, I could never have given that to Katie. Never. If I'd coached her for a million years, I could never have come up with that. She came up with it from herself, from her own creativity. And those solutions are always better than anything that your doctor could tell you to do, because it comes from yourself.
I need to start thinking, like you said, I used to love reading in bed when I was younger. I just can't focus on a book anymore. But I wonder if I gave myself a tiny amount of time, like you said, like 10 minutes, whether I would be able to absorb for 10 minutes. It's worth a go rather than sitting on the old Instagram.
5 minutes.
Five minutes. And see if I can actually focus.
Yeah. A page. Well, that might not be right for you, but I also used to love reading. Mm. And then when I had kids, it got relegated to something I only did on holiday. You know, that was my treat time to read a novel. But I realized that I really like reading novels. And now I go to my local library and I don't see it as an indulgence. I see it as part of my self-care that, you know, I really enjoy literature.
Mm. Yeah, and you have to have a bit of self-care. You have to find ways, don't you? Even like I try and listen to podcasts or audible books when I'm doing other things, like trying to walk the dog or trying to prepare dinner, because they're boring tasks, but making it a little bit more soothing for me. And it's kind of you're getting things done, but you're also kind of mentally having a little bit of a break while you're doing them, because you're listening to something you want to listen to. But the self-compassion thing is really tricky, because a lot of us really struggle with that. They're like, well, what? Just be nice to yourself. It feels very alien. You know, we're not Americans. We're not Americans taught to be.
I agree with you.
With ourselves. Have you got any tips for starting out with trying to do a bit of self-compassion? Any little things people can try for me, whenever I try to say something, I just don't believe it. So that doesn't work. Without, like you said, without the self-compassion, you can't then start doing the self-care and start doing the things that are essential to help you through or prevent things like burnout and exhaustion.
Yeah, sure. I know one of the things that has been life-changing for me is journaling. I journal every morning and I cannot even begin to tell you how many benefits I've had. So if I'm like in a really stinky mood or feeling like I've cocked up at work or whatever, I would like scroll out. I mean, I just have literally just like an A4 pad. You know, it's nothing fancy, but there's something about getting it out on paper, which creates distance between you and the feelings and the beating ourselves up and the frustration and the resentment or whatever it is, the fear. And I then, once I've got it out, I will then write from a different point of view. So I'll almost like change heads and I'll write, what do I need to know now? And then I'll write with a different voice, and I'll see myself writing things like, actually, you were really courageous to try that thing at work. And actually, you're doing really well. And, you know, look at all that you've achieved. You know, it'll be a totally different voice in my head. And I can decide, so I can kind of talk myself down, well, write myself down using journaling. But I guess just almost picturing yourself as if you were a baby. So if you've got a toddler, you know, and they're learning to walk, when they kind of take those few very unsteady steps and then they fall on their bottom, we kind of clap them, don't we? We don't say, oh, you're so stupid, you fell, you're an idiot, you're a failure. I mean, can you imagine saying that? I mean, it's unthinkable. It's unthinkable that we would say that to a tiny little child who's trying to learn to walk. And yet we talk to ourselves like that. You know, we're trying to change habits. We're trying to start to exercise or eat better. And, you know, we mess up one day and immediately it's kind of starting with you know, you'll never do it. You're a total failure. You know, you think you're going to change. All of this awful self-talk. But kind of just imagining ourselves as our baby selves, that kind of makes us feel like a little bit more maternal, I guess, to ourselves. And you know, we would never speak to a friend like that, would we? And
that's the thing I was going to say. We don't talk
would.
To other people like that. And it
no.
sounds like the journaling method you use is
yeah.
so you'll pick something that's going on that you're not happy about, or you're just...
Yeah.
Is it like a template? Do you start writing what you don't like?
No, I literally write whatever is on my mind. So it will flit from one thing to the next, because that's the mind does. It totally flits. I'll just pick it up in the morning. So I do this every morning, and it will just be like, oh, you know what? I'm worried I didn't get this podcast recorded yesterday, and I was supposed to write this, and I'm behind with this. Da, 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 da. And then I'm worried about, you know, one of my kids doing whatever is on my mind, literally just comes out onto the page, and it evolves. As you write, you start to find solutions to things. It's very difficult to describe unless you've experienced it for yourself. But it's amazing what happens. I hold a monthly session called Peppermint Pause, where I do in a group session, we do journaling, we do a gratitude practice, and we do lots of kind of self-calming things. We do tapping. And all of the women said, like, I don't, like, you can see them getting nervous when I say, grab your pen and paper, because they're like, I don't journal. I don't want to journal. I think it reminds them of school, maybe. You can see like the revelation that happens afterwards. They'll be like, the pen just wouldn't stop. Once I started, the pen wouldn't stop. And I'm really amazed at what I've written. So it's definitely worth having a try.
Are there any templates for questions for people that wouldn't know where to start, or certain questions that they should always ask themselves when they're going to do that journaling before they start reframing it?
I don't tend to use those, but if I'm doing the journaling with my group, I will ask them things like, what have I achieved so far, you know, this year? And actually, there can be so much more than when you actually start writing it down and think, gosh, actually, I've done quite a lot. I've come quite a long way. Or, you know, what can I do to be kind to myself? So I asked that at my peppermint pause last month. And one of the ladies, she was in her 30s, I think, she said, I don't know what that means. I don't know what it means to be kind to myself. I literally have no idea. So just getting her to gently, gently explore, you know, what that might be. And actually the next day she messaged me and she said, I'm in a cafe. I've just had my nails done and I'm just people watching. It's about sometimes you need someone to give you permission to actually do something nice for yourself, because we're not used to it and we feel guilty about it.
Yeah, that is, I think, especially for parents, I think that feeling that you're always supposed to be giving to them instead of having that
that's
time
it.
For yourself, isn't it? So that sounds really good. So it sounds like you've almost posing the questions in themselves can help you automatically start to do the self-compassion that you might not ordinarily do. And even if you're just sitting there going, this has been really bad, this has been awful, I'm not good at this.
Yeah.
You can turn it around and then afterwards go, right, well, how would I reframe this? How if I was a friend or someone else and they were saying this to me, what would I say to them when they're dissing themselves and saying they can't do anything? It sounds like that's the purpose of it is to be that other voice for yourself. And then, I don't know, over time, will you automatically start doing that self-compassion?
I still do the journaling, because the thing is, you can sort through the, you know, the toxic emotions like the fear, shame, anger, whatever. But then the fact of life is they'll crop up again, because that's the thing, is emotions change like the weather. So it's not like the work is ever done, because tomorrow someone might say something that pisses you off and then, you know, you're back feeling. That's why it's a daily practice for me of just sorting through. And over time, it definitely makes you more emotionally resilient, because you get to see that even when you feel really scared or angry or whatever it is, it passes. Everything passes. So if I were to flick back to my journal to say before I started my podcast, however many, 3 years ago, there was abject terror. There was literally like, this is the worst decision I've ever made. This is the worst mistake. What are you thinking of? It's going to be a failure. And it was the fear, you know, we try to protect ourselves from being hurt, being criticized. But I can read that and understand, okay, that was fear, but actually it was a bit of an overreaction. I understand I was trying to protect myself from criticism. But then you see the next day, it changes. So everything shifts, everything changes. You know, there's a lovely saying, this too shall pass. And it's true, everything passes. But with my journal, I can actually see in writing how I was very upset one day, but then the next day it had passed. So it gives you the understanding that, yes, I might feel angry today or whatever, but this will pass. It's not who I am. It's not a permanent state. It's just a fleeting feeling. Feelings shift. They naturally move unless they're stuck. So we don't want to suppress them. We want to allow them to shift, and they do shift naturally.
So it sounds like when looking at burnout in general, a lot of your tips have been things like get rest, find ways to even go to bed a little bit earlier, find ways to make it more time for yourself, even if it's 5-10 minutes reading a book before bed if you can't fit it in during the day with the kids and things like that. Start to try to find ways to be self-compassionate, whether that's journaling, like you said, which I think is a really good one for people that haven't done it, you know, aren't very good at being compassionate, and self-care, and knowing your boundaries, like you said, introducing some boundaries so that people won't constantly take from you, whether it's work, family, whatever. The other side I wanted to ask as well is because I know you're also very keyed up on things like food.
Very.
I'm assuming that's another area, like you said, with the water, keeping hydrated.
So
what can food do to help? Are there any tips of things to do while you're in burnout or whatever to try and, I suppose, I'm assuming vitamins, nutrients, things like that will help boost well-being or things like that?
Totally. So there's a very, very strong link between our mental state and the food that we're eating. This is very, very well established. So yes, I've already touched on keeping hydrated, because even if you get a little bit dehydrated, even, you know, 1-2%, already your brain is starting to malfunction. So it's this basics of keeping hydrated, keeping our blood sugar stable is massive. So if, for example, you're having a breakfast of, say, I don't know, a bagel or a croissant or some cereal, or, you know, something that gives you a blood glucose spike, which is what I used to do up until my mid-40s, because I had no idea that piece of toast was not a good breakfast, or my Shreddies or Weetabix. I had no idea that was not a good breakfast. So once you get that spike and you get like, so for me, I would get hangry, you know, that kind of very awful mix of being starving and like angry because you're desperate for the next piece of toast. So in that state, I basically put my body and my mind into a state of panic. And that affects you, totally affects your mental health. You know, your brain is like in a high alert and everything's a problem. So you can't hope to be in an emotionally strong place if your blood sugar is all over the place. So managing your blood sugar by starting whatever time you have your first meal, making sure that you're having protein and good fats. So when I switch to kind of having fried eggs, for example, avocado, say sweet potato, or today I had like a full fat Greek yogurt with lots of nuts and seeds. So that's why I'm able to talk to you now and not be like a crazy woman and being shaky and my tummy rumbling, is because I've had a breakfast that stabilizes my blood sugar.
Yeah, I do need to learn more about that area, I think, because hangry is a big one. Yeah,
I hate being hangry.
And I think as well, we've got, when we look at things like neurodivergence, there are a lot of people that have sensory issues around food.
Yeah.
So sometimes what is the typical advice of you need to drink water? Well, some people are very funny about that, and the texture of it, the flavor, there's no flavor, so they just can't literally do it. Some people, there's certain snacks they don't like the feeling in their mouths, so they will opt for things that are not so good nutritionally. So I guess that's a whole other area. I mean, I would love for you to come back on to actually talk about food and well-being.
Yeah.
When looking at, you know, especially people that can't eat certain foods, how they can improve their well-being in that area, but also how different foods and drinks play negative and positive with
for
our
sure. I used to actually work for the food industry. So when I was doing PR for the first however many years, 15 years actually for the food industry. So I know that a lot of the foods unfortunately that are pushed at us are very addictive, and they do have really nice textures, and the way they're designed in laboratories is for us to kind of be hooked on them. And it's so much easier to grab a packet of biscuits, you know, when you're tired and hungry and you haven't made time for lunch. And that's what I see happening a lot with women. But then it feels good in the moment, but then afterwards, obviously, they feel awful. And long term, it has obviously very detrimental effects on our health and also our mental health. So making the time to plan, if you can, so you've got food that's to hand, because it's hard. You know, if you get to that stage where you're tired and you forgot to have lunch, and then you open the fridge and nothing inspires you and you just can't be bothered. But if you've kind of got things that are ready, it's like it just takes a weight off. And things that you know you like, because they're all different. You might like things that are totally different to what I like. And you've really got to enjoy your food. So it's finding things that you like to eat that are simple and quick for you to make that are going to keep your blood sugars steady and are going to give you what you need, you know, to be fueled properly, your mind, your body, you know, eating a rainbow of vegetables, eating good quality protein, eating lots of fiber, because most of us are totally devoid of fiber, to feed our gut health. And we know that our gut health massively affects our mental health. So it's really, you know, looking after our guts so that our brain can function properly. It's a very involved subject.
No, it's one that I'm really interested in. So I really would like to speak to someone, hopefully it'll be you, about how, all of that, especially like, you know, serotonin in the gut and how, you know, all these probiotic stuff. And there's such a big argument for and against probiotics. And I never know what the best thing is with that long term, especially, you know, as a mother as well, not just for me myself. But there's a huge link to certain things. You need to have certain nutrients and vitamins and minerals to help boost motivation, mood, things like that. And I think, yeah, a lot of us, when we don't have much time and rushing around, we don't notice that we're lacking some of that. So deficiencies in vitamins can cause a lot of issues with mental health and physical health, can't they? So it's a massive area that I'd really like to cover, because I also want to refresh my learning and start amending my own diet, because I think it's probably severely lacking in certain things, which isn't helping me mentally or physically. So that's brilliant. And I'd also like to ask you about the mushrooms you've tried on. I think, was it your own podcast or someone else's? But that would probably be
my podcast.
I did,
in the interest of telling my listeners about psychedelic drugs, I did go to the Netherlands on a retreat and take magic mushrooms.
Did that work for you? Was it good or
no?
It didn't work.
No,
for you. There's a lot of, at the moment, there's a lot
horrendous. I expected to have this thoroughly spiritual experience and to kind of come away understanding the meaning of life, which is what I'd heard a lot of other people had experienced. That it's never something I thought I would do. I mean, I'd never taken drugs in my life. I mean, I'd never smoked. I was just, I don't even drink. So for me to kind of go from that to taking magic mushrooms was a hell of a leap. But what happened was I'd been following the research for quite a number of years, and I was very interested in the benefits for people struggling with mental health. There were a lot of trials going on in the UK, but it wasn't something I'd ever thought for myself, because I wasn't particularly struggling with my mental health. I wasn't eligible for it. But what happened was I was approached by someone who wanted to talk about my podcast. And I said, you know what, I will talk about it, but only if I can talk from a first person perspective, so I can give a real life, true, honest opinion to my listeners. And it was horrific.
I'm really surprised, because I've heard a lot about having tiny bits of it, obviously.
I had a huge dose. Because she gave me a dose, and then she gave me another dose, and then she gave me another dose. And by the end of it, she said she'd given me a boxer's dose. And it was the most horrendous hour afterwards of probably of my life. It was, and I actually came back to Manchester. I still had heart palpitations, and I'd never had heart palpitations in my life. I'd never had an anxiety attack. I'd never been out of my mind like I was. It was a very terrifying experience.
And did you record your views of it on your podcast then? Can we find that? How do we locate that? Because I want to listen to it.
It wasn't the episode that I planned to record, but it was the episode that was true and honest. And I think it was much more nuanced than the episode I had planned, because yes, we talked about the benefits, but we also talked about the risks. And I knew firsthand now about the risks, because I'd experienced the downside. Because you never know when you take a psychedelic drug, you just don't know what's going to happen. You can go up, you can go down, got no idea. And even though I had gone with all my self-care, with all my positivity, with all my journaling, with all my health coach credentials, you know, with all the work that I had done on myself in the 6 weeks prior, even on top of what I normally do, I had still had that bad trip. So if it could happen to me, frankly, it could happen to anybody. I mean, I was with someone who was very experienced. She was able to kind of look after me afterwards. Thank God I wasn't like, you know, in someone's yurt in a group of like 20 people. I was in a place where I was with a skilled therapist, but all I would say is, you know, these are very unpredictable substances. You just don't know what's going to happen. I'm still absolutely all for it, still following the research, but I'm just a little bit more cautious now. You only read the good stuff. You only read the, you know, the miracle stories of people who were cured from depression or anxiety or eating disorders, but you don't hear so much about the people who had bad trips.
And it does sound like you had way too much, because I think a lot of the research these days is about really having the tiniest of microdose to help, rather than actually experiencing, like you did,
exactly,
an actual trip. Like, that's way too much. That scares me. Like, I'm like you, I don't do drugs, and the thought of it scares me. But this one, I'm open to, because it's a mushroom from the ground, and I think a tiny bit. There's so much research showing how
so
it
much
can aid
research.
so many things that I think, well, maybe one day, if it ever gets to a point of being something that we can microdose. I mean, they use it in, I think some therapists use it. Is it America? To actually help, like, couples, and they have a tiny bit where they actually are able to then talk to each other about feelings they don't usually talk about, or unlock sort of inner stuff that they block, which I find fascinating.
It is fascinating. And the research, I mean, there's some amazing research to do with how it allows the brain to sort of reconfigure itself. And even people who've got a terminal illness, even with one single dose, and they found that they've lost all fear of death, that actually that they are happier than they've ever been. So there's incredible research, but I wouldn't want people to just go and just try it for themselves, you know,
No, it would have to be under guidance, wouldn't it? And then, yeah, like you said, it's, and especially now, we still don't have it as something that we can legally do here. So it's really important to work with people where they understand the risks, that they are professionals in helping with this. I definitely wouldn't advise it. So no one take that from the pod. Don't go and do it. That's what I'm saying. But maybe one day we'll be at a point where this country will have some form of usage of it. Who knows? But that's a whole other podcaster's episode.
Yeah,
that
totally.
one. But yeah, no, definitely. So what was the name of your podcast then, so people can go and take a listen?
So it's called Midlife Illuminated. But it's for any age. I mean, I'm now 52, so it's not like a menopause podcast. It's just kind of my thoughts, you know, what I've learned in this very peculiar journey that I've been on, feeling better at 52 than I, you know, have ever done, and a whole lot calmer and a lot more emotionally resilient.
Brilliant. I definitely need to have a listen to that. I'm definitely in the demographic now. How do other people find you if they want to look at the coaching side that you do?
Sure. So my website is Peppermint Wellness on Instagram, Facebook, also under Peppermint Wellness. And if you go on my website, I do actually have an app called Wellness Unwrapped, and it has a free program on there, which I've called 5 Days to Calm. And it's just 5 very short videos where I show you how to do my top things for self-calming, including tapping. And these are the things that I just want everyone to know, because if you've got those in your toolbox and you can learn to do even one of them regularly, they do really increase your emotional resilience.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's been really a great reminder of what I need to start trying to do. I hope it's been useful for other people. And I think, yeah, we can't cover everything about burnout in one episode because we'd be here all day. But you've given us a few little things to try, whether it's journaling, taking a little bit of time for ourselves, however we can fit that in, whether it's a book in bed for 5 minutes, whether it's a cup of tea while the kids have got the telly on, you know, finding a little bit of time for ourselves and trying to be kinder in our inner monologue to ourselves. And like you said, I think the big one is boundaries. So starting to put in some boundaries around time, space for yourself, you know, what you can and can't give, being more realistic of what you should and shouldn't be giving to people, and trying to find support in that, and being open about where you're at, I think is another one I would add, with people around you so that they can support you.
Totally.
Because I think, like you said, we mask it. A lot of us mask it and just get on with it. But people don't realise we need some support, and actually sometimes we can't put those boundaries in, and other people need to do it for us sometimes. Yeah. And I think that's really key, to be open about it. But thank you so much for coming on, and I'm definitely going to be listening to, like, your pod, and I know which episode I'm going for first. And I really do hope that you do come back so we can explore food, because that would be amazing.
I'd love to. Thank you so much, Claire. It's been lovely to chat to you.
And you. Thank you. Bye.
If you've liked this episode, please help us out by liking, subscribing, or leaving us a review, as this helps us to reach more people. If you've got any ideas about topics to cover on future episodes, or questions about the pod, or you even want to be interviewed for it, please get in touch on our socials using @mindvoxpod on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, or email us on mindvoxpod@gmail.com.